This is 1A. Happy Friday. I'm Joshua Johnson, visiting WDET Public Radio in Detroit. America's intelligence chiefs made a surprise appearance at a White House press briefing to warn of foreign interference in the midterm elections. Hours later, at a rally in Pennsylvania, President Trump did not mention his intelligence chiefs' warnings, but he did speak of the, quote, Russian hoax. We also learned the price of ostrich and snakeskin jackets this week as the trial of Paul Manafort got underway. The former Trump campaign chairman is charged with bank fraud. And the Labor Department reported that the unemployment rate is 3.9%. Joining us here in Detroit for the Friday News Roundup is Eugene Scott, who covers politics for The Washington Post. Eugene, welcome back to the Roundup.
Thanks for having me.
Ested Herndon is a national politics reporter for The New York Times. Ested, welcome to 1A.
Thank you.
And Stephen Henderson is the host of Detroit Today from WDET 101.9 FM here in Detroit. Stephen, welcome back.
Thank you.
America's top intelligence chiefs have vowed to defend America's elections against what they call real threats from Russia. The heads of the CIA, the FBI, the NSA, and other agencies took to the podium during yesterday's White House press briefing. They hammered home the point that Russia is behind a pervasive campaign to influence the 2018 midterm elections. Here is Homeland Security Secretary Kirstjen Nielsen.
Our democracy itself is in the crosshairs. Free and fair elections are the cornerstone of our democracy, and it has become clear that they are the target of our adversaries who seek, as the DNI just said, to sow discord and undermine our way of life.
That was Secretary of State Homeland Security Secretary Kirstjen Nielsen. And, of course, the DNI she referred to is the Director of National Intelligence, Dan Coats. All this comes less than a month after President Trump met with Russia's President Vladimir Putin and seemed to take Mr. Putin's word for it that Russia was not involved in election interference. Eugene Scott, I want to talk more about what the president said at the rally in just a second, but take just this one statement by itself. How significant is this really, particularly because Chris Wray, the director of the FBI, and Dan Coats have never, ever seemed to doubt the reality that Russia interfered in our election. But for all of them to make this statement together, how big a deal is that?
I think it's a really big deal for Americans who are genuinely concerned about Russia's interest in the next steps of interfering in American elections. The question obviously remains, how serious is this to the president himself and to those among his base? What Congress is going to do and what those Americans who are genuinely concerned about national security and our safety are going to do in response to the midterm elections is what I think a lot of people will be paying attention to.
And of course, President Trump did seem quite reticent, has been consistently, to fully embrace this idea that Russia was involved in interfering in the elections. For instance, at the summit with Mr. Putin, the president said he didn't see any reason why it would be Russia. He later clarified or said he was making a clarification to say he meant to say wouldn't rather than would, and then immediately added, could have been anybody. Now, last night, the president spoke at a rally in Wilkes-Barre, Pennsylvania, and again referred to the investigation as a hoax.
In Helsinki, I had a great meeting with Putin. We discussed everything. I had a great meeting. We got along really well. By the way, that's a good thing, not a bad thing. That's a really good thing. Now, we're being hindered by the Russian hoax. It's a hoax, okay?
President speaking at a rally last night in Wilkes-Barre, Pennsylvania. Stephen Henderson, I wonder what you make of the press conference, whether that signals a shift from the White House itself. It's interesting that we have the president saying one thing and then the administration saying something else. What about that split?
Yeah, I think that reflects a discord that has existed since the beginning between the sort of Washington establishment that backs every White House and the particulars of this White House, including the president and some of those close to him who are trying to push back. One of the things I think is really significant about what they were talking about yesterday, though, is this idea that this is an ongoing effort by the Russians. This wasn't just about 2016. It's about 2018. It'll be about 2020. And I think one of the things we need to start asking is whether we have been distracted by the president's dissembling about this from really focusing on how do we keep the Russians out of our elections? How do we defend ourselves and our voting systems and our voting process against a foreign power that is really actively trying to disrupt it?
Well, yeah, and the intelligence community has made clear that this didn't just begin
with the
2016 election.
That's
we kind of felt it in 2016, but it didn't start then. But instead, Herndon, that was exactly what I was going to ask you about, is whether we have a better sense now of whether anything is being done to actually push back against this election interference. They've said that they are going to protect the democratic process, that this is an extant threat, that we have to do something. Do we know what they're doing, or is that still kind of fuzzy?
It's still kind of fuzzy. I mean, it's kind of unclear just the extent to which this administration is taking this seriously through action. And so there's a mismatch between rhetoric and the actual steps being taken to protect our elections. You have folks like the administration officials that we talked about making these kind of strong rhetorical statements, but there's been still a absence of real action to shore up election systems. I mean, we've had a lack of investment on these issues, and so it still becomes something that we're you look at the president and you wonder how much this is being taken seriously, and things like the Helsinki press conference only add to those questions.
Regarding those rallies and some of the president's rhetoric, Dean emailed, since the president has continued his aggressive behavior towards the press should unify and quit attending his campaign events. That takes the press out of danger and may force the president to change his outrageous behavior. He demands that he be the center of attention. Removing that may stop his bombastic nonsense. Jason wrote on Facebook Live, nice looking panel. I agree. Let's talk a little bit more about another Russia story that moved. They're not really a Russia story, but part of the Mueller investigation, not directly related to Russian interference, but the first trial to come out of that investigation, which is the trial of former Trump campaign manager Paul Manafort. It officially got underway. Eugene, give us a sense of what this trial is about and whether or not it could have any impact on the Russia investigation.
There's a lot of interest in this trial right now regarding how much people around Manafort knew about his involvement with wiring money from foreign accounts to make purchases in the U.S., how many people in the campaign were aware of this interaction, what role the campaign could have possibly played in some type of illegal activity. There's a consistent effort to see if there was a relationship between Manafort's behavior and inappropriate behavior from the Trump campaign. If there is a connection that can be made, that could play a huge part in the Russian investigation. And the reason why there's so much interest in it is because of Manafort's relationship with some political parties that have been in inappropriate interaction with the Russian government themselves.
Estelle, have there been any big highlights of this trial so far? I mean, it seemed like it's supposed to move pretty quickly. The prosecution said they plan to wrap up their part of this next week. What have we seen so far?
So we've seen some details just in terms of the scope of what Paul Manafort is accused of. And it's kind of an insight for folks who are kind of unaware of the foreign lobbying world, just how deep that universe goes. And so we see this just extreme amounts of money that was poured into these lobbying efforts and kind of the strange amounts of money that Paul Manafort spent his money on. I mean, things like Oriental rugs, things like very special like coats and garments. And and you know, that's what the prosecution is trying to say was part of this illegal effort. But you know, I think the biggest thing here is the connections with the president for this former campaign manager and what that says. I mean, Trump has always said he hires the best people, and here he has his former campaign manager mired in what is a long scope of lobbying scheme that is international, and it's, you know, just we don't know the extent of it.
The president tweeted yesterday, quote, looking back on history, who was treated worse, Alphonse Capone, legendary mob boss, killer, and public enemy number one, or Paul Manafort, political operative and Reagan Dole darling, now serving solitary confinement, although convicted of nothing? Where is the Russia collusion? Unquote. Now, again, he's not in solitary, but I think there is a growing appetite for closure in this whole thing. I mean, one of our listeners tweeted, Russia, why are we still talking about Russia when there is not still is not one minute shred of evidence? Likewise, Manafort ordeal is tax issue, nothing else.
Yeah. I mean, I obviously would maybe disagree with the listener there about what we've learned and what we can conclude at this point. I think we are still waiting to see the details of how these relationships worked, how all of this took place in 2016, and what role the president may or may not have played in it. And so it's a little early to say that we haven't seen anything. I mean, this is the president's campaign manager who is on trial. A little later, we'll see a trial of the president's longtime attorney. If those two people were involved with these relationships, it's hard to believe that the president wasn't. His entire approach here, of course, has been to, again, dissemble, to say things that take your eye off the central question and make it seem as though this is some sort of witch hunt. But I think it's been managed in a very serious and credible way, and we'll see what comes out at these trials.
Speaking of witch hunts, that was also the focus of one of the president's tweets that made headlines this week. He seemed to issue a public call for Attorney General Jeff Sessions to shut down the Russia probe. On Wednesday, the president tweeted, quote, "This is a terrible situation, and Attorney General Jeff Sessions should stop this rigged witch hunt right now before it continues to stain our country any further," unquote. Now, White House Press Secretary Sarah Sanders dismissed questions over whether this was an order. Sanders said it was just the president stating his opinion.
Look, the president is not obstructing. He's fighting back. The president is stating his opinion. He's stating it clearly. And he's certainly expressing the frustration that he has with the level of corruption that we've seen from people like Jim Comey, Peter Strzok, Andrew McCabe. There's a reason that the president's angry. And frankly, most of America is angry as well. And there's no reason he shouldn't be able to voice that opinion.
Press Secretary Sarah Sanders contextualizing the president's tweet. Instead, I wonder what we make of this. We already know that Robert Mueller, the special counsel, considers the president's tweets fair game. How do we parse this? The president expressing his opinion to someone to whom he could just give an order.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, on one hand, we have a statement from the White House itself that says take these tweets as presidential statements. But then at the same time, you have a president that just muses on Twitter about what he likely sees on Fox and Friends in the morning. And we don't know how to take that. I mean, we have multiple instances of this. I remember the order banning transgender military officers from serving in the military. He tweeted out but had never communicated to the military officials. And something like this, the White House called the New York Times to clarify that this was not a president, this wasn't an order, but a mere statement from the president. And so you have a situation in which you have an elected official who, unlike really anyone of his kind, just muses and says how he feels, but at the same time, we don't know how to take that. And so it signals a deep frustration with folks like the Attorney General that we know is reflected deeply in the Republican Party, but is that going to lead to action? We don't know.
It's also important to correct something that Sanders said. She implied that a majority of the American people feel the same way that the president does about this investigation in terms of wanting it to be over. A plurality of Americans in polling that came out this week would like to see the investigation continue. Now, we do know that the president supposedly has implemented a strategy to attack the investigation every day with the hope that its popularity will decrease. And that has been shown to be somewhat effective and extremely effective among Republicans. But most Americans, 48%, or a plurality of Americans, we should say, want to see this move forward.
Let me get to a few of your comments before we move forward with the roundup. Paul wrote on our Facebook page, "To those grousing about how long the Mueller probe is dragging on, I'll remind them that in this interval of the Ken Starr investigation, the phrase blue dress meant to America only that a dress was blue." Another listener tweeted, "That audio," meaning the audio from the rally in Wilkes-Barre, Pennsylvania, "that audio is scary. Americans are literally cheering for Russia. Does this make sense anymore?" Corey wrote on our Facebook page, "Anyone who genuinely believes there's no evidence of wrongdoing on behalf of everyone around the president, if not also the president himself, are so far gone from the world of facts that I wonder how they operate on a day-to-day basis." The facts we get sometimes come through social media. We know what role social media played in the misinformation around the 2016 election, and that moves us to how Facebook made news this week. The company says it's discovered and deleted more than 24 fake pages and profiles that were designed to influence your opinions ahead of the midterms. Nearly 300,000 users had been drawn to the fake accounts through ads, events, and a barrage of posts on subjects from fascism to feminism to free speech. Some left-leaning activists accused Facebook of censorship after this move. They claimed that it removed events and pages that were legitimate and helped combat white supremacy. This after weeks of Facebook being accused of censorship from the right after blocking Alex Jones, the creator and host of InfoWars, and allegedly removing some right-leaning pages. Stephen, this feels like a tightrope that Facebook is figuring out how to walk. And granted, it's a gigantic organization, 2 billion people. They're in uncharted territory. No one knows how to do what Facebook is doing. But I wonder how we see Facebook dealing with this, especially because it knows that the influence campaign that was so effective on Facebook is not going away.
Yeah. I mean, I think there's no question that Facebook needs to take more responsibility than it has historically for the way it is used, right? You have people who are making Facebook into a weapon in this effort to undermine American elections. That's not something they should be a party to in any way. At the same time, I mean, I have a little bit of sympathy for Facebook because, as you point out, they're in this very strange space that there is no precedent for. Is Facebook a platform? Is Facebook a publisher? Those kinds of questions make it really difficult for the people at Facebook to figure out what their responsibilities actually look like. I like the idea of them being more aggressive the way they were this week than they have been. But there is going to come a point where they do something like this and it's illegitimate, right? That they deactivate somebody's account mistakenly. But I think that's the side they need to be erring on, at least at this point, as we try to figure out how to manage that new space in a way that's responsible.
I should also note, by the way, that we're hearing from quite a few of you who are also appreciative of some of what the president has been tweeting about the coverage around the administration and the talk of the Russia probe. Charlie wrote on our Facebook page, "I appreciate his tweets. It's a great way to combat the left-leaning negative media." Since we're talking about the internet, we should also mention some T-shirts and signs that went up at a Trump rally this week that drew some attention to a fringe conspiracy theory that's growing in some corners of the web. It's called QAnon. Jerry emailed asking about QAnon, wants to know your thoughts. QAnon describes a vast conspiracy theory that posits that a shadowy cabal of globalists have been controlling the government for more than a century, and that President Trump is the savior who will bring the, quote, storm to Washington. The name QAnon comes from Q, a poster on Reddit, who believers say possesses Q-level security clearance. Now, I don't want to get too deep into what this theory is. It involves the number 17 and the sinking of the Titanic and pedophiles and a lot of other things. We don't have time to talk about it. But instead, I kind of wonder what context you think we should put this in. There is something to, I feel like, the legitimate critique of supporters of President Trump who say the government has been controlled by too narrow a set of interests for too long. I wonder if QAnon is the natural apotheosis of that, whether it's just a fringe. What is this?
I mean, I think that there's a lot of going on here. I mean, one, we should be clear that this is the latest iteration of what is a longstanding flirtation with Trump supporters and conspiracy. I mean, QAnon is the latest. We have had several instances in which Trump supporters have from Pizzagate of the past, and you know, when I would go to Trump rallies in 2016 and write stories about what was going on there, I would hear how Hillary Clinton was running a pedophile child sex ring in her basement often. I mean, that was not a fringe idea. And so I think one of the things that we should be clear about is why these beliefs are certainly may seem crazy or may seem fringe, that this is a pervasive kind of and continuous belief among a section of supporters. And so I think that this is a president who traffics in the internet and has supported some of these more, you know, conspiracy theorists and artists, folks like Alex Jones, Jack Posobiec, and the like. And so what happens is you get things like this, and we don't know exactly where that leads.
Monica wrote on our Facebook page, "Thank you for addressing QAnon. No one is talking about it." Joe tweeted, Hashtag Make America Great Again, hashtag QAnon, deep state shills. That is what all those so-called journalists are in the White House press pool. They don't give a damn about the common man, just their deep state buddies. Eugene, I feel like theories like this kind of feed what in some cases might be a legitimate concern about whether or not Washington is speaking to the needs of people who are far from the Beltway. Maybe QAnon goes a little bit too far.
Sure.
But perhaps there's something, if you kind of unpeel this underneath it, that is worth talking about.
Absolutely. And another thing worth talking about is the disconnect some of these Americans who caricature journalists have with the reality of our real lives. They seem to think that we only are doing life in the Beltway or only connected to the Beltway and are not real Americans ourselves who grew up in the Midwest, who went to school in the South, who have family members from working class communities that they come from as well, who are concerned about some of the very same issues that they are. And so it's fascinating. And the inconsistency of QAnon in reasoning is mind-blowing. I mean, one prevalent theory going around QAnon is that Obama and Clinton are in cahoots with Russia. These are the same people at a rally who now think that it may not have been bad to collude with Russia if you're beating Hillary Clinton, who is in cahoots with Russia. It's just really confusing and doesn't make a lot of sense.
If I was in the deep state, I wouldn't still be paying as much on my student loans. That's all I would not
You'd have had those wiped out.
They would have been gone. They would have never happened. They would have never happened.
Never happened.
Let's talk immigration for a moment. This week, the court stepped in again to pull back one of President Trump's hardline immigration policies. An appeals court ruled that the president acted outside his authority when he issued an executive order. The order would withhold funds from so-called sanctuary cities for refusing to cooperate with federal immigration authorities. The ruling called that executive order unconstitutional, but it only affects two jurisdictions, San Francisco and Santa Clara County, California. That's where the city of San Jose is. Estead, what does it mean for these places and for the debate over sanctuary cities in a larger sense?
This sanctuary cities has been a kind of the crux of the immigration issue. I mean, you've had a lot of local mayors, local cities, some governors who have tried to insulate their communities from the Trumpian hardline immigration policies by saying this place will not back deportations in that same type of way. We won't have our local law enforcement officers coordinate. What we have here is a court rejection of what was the Trump pushback to that. You have the Trump administration say, you know what, if you're going to do that, then that means that we're going to take away federal funds from your city and place. And the court is now saying that that is an abuse of power. And so, this is not going to be something that goes away. I mean, in kind of the most drastic incident, you had a Washington mayor get beat up because a Trump supporter was upset over sanctuary cities. But you have this as a crux kind of key issue in the immigration debate. And although this weapon has now been taken away by the courts, it's not going anywhere.
In Northern California, well, the Bay Area in particular has been part of the big pushback
Yep.
over sanctuary cities in a number of different ways.
Yep.
We also learned, Stephen, that the Trump administration is considering reducing the number of refugees that can enter the country mm-hmm. next year. The senior policy advisor, Stephen Miller, is reportedly pushing the cut inside the White House. Now, last fall, the president cut that number to a record low of 45,000 per year. I wonder what sense we have, Stephen, of what kind of impact that could make going forward, whether it would affect certain parts of the world, whether it would have a ripple effect on resettlement worldwide. Mm-hmm. I mean, what do we – and again, this is still kind of a proposal, but what do we see as the potential impact of this if there's another cut?
Well, it's a change, a fundamental change to who we are as a country. I mean, think about that. The idea that we would refuse more people who are fleeing political persecution and other kinds of things around the globe – that's not an America that I'm terribly familiar with. Also, as a Detroiter, I just have to say, you think of this community, this part of the world, this is a very heavily influenced space by immigrants and refugees right here in the city of Detroit. We have a really special place where we take in refugees and try to help them gain citizenship here. So, I mean, those are very scary notions to me, and they would have an effect worldwide on people's ability to get to a safe space away from political persecution. You know, I really think that that this is the worst part of what the Trump administration has sort of brought to us in the time it's been in Washington is this effect that they want to have on legal immigration. This is a guy who campaigned very strongly against illegal immigration and said he wanted to crack down on it. A lot of what they've been doing is pulling back on the ability of people to come here under circumstances that many of our ancestors came here. It's just not right.
Let's talk about the economy. On Monday, the New York Times reported that the Trump administration is considering bypassing Congress to grant what would amount to a tax cut for the wealthy worth about $100 billion. It would do this by changing the way that the Treasury Department calculates capital gains taxes. Those are the taxes that are paid on profits from the sales of assets like a home or like stocks. Eugene, what sense do you get of what the Treasury Department hopes to gain from this calculation, what kinds of changes it wants to make? What's behind this?
Well, it's not completely clear yet, and I think that's one of the main questions that many voters have been asking who got behind Trump hoping that these types of cuts would benefit working class Americans more. It appears to be the latest example of cuts possibly benefiting wealthy Americans far more significantly than those who are making significantly less money, which is not the biggest surprise once you think about it. As much attention has been paid to how many white working class voters President Trump won, he also won some of the wealthiest voters as well. And so seeing how he is going to communicate to this demographic that has been upset about some other policy proposals coming from this administration related to trade impacting farmers specifically, how this message is going to be a winning one. This approach to taxes is going to be a winning one this midterm elections.
Is it clear, Estead, that the president can or should do this unilaterally? I mean, some Democrats in Congress certainly have criticized this and have urged the Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin to kind of stand down and say that this needs to be made through legislation. Is this something the president can do or that he has the support of his party to do?
That's a tough question. I mean, it is. I don't think this is unprecedented ground if this would be done unilaterally. And there certainly would be some pushback from members of Congress who are used to, and I think a country that is used to this being passed through like more traditional legislation. But what we see is a president who has, even though he has been characterized as a populist or someone who breaks the mold of traditional Republican economic policy, he has campaigned in a way that has been very traditional. I mean, he's governed in a way that's been very traditional in terms of top-down tax cuts, in terms of trickle-down economics. I mean, this is the tax cut legislation that was passed last year is centered on that ideal. And so you have a president who, although the rhetoric may seem to point towards a shift in the Republican Party in terms of tariffs, I mean, certainly the tariffs have been a shift, but has looked as an economic populist, if you want to use that term, has campaigned in the traditional governing as a Republican.
Stephen Henderson, what sense do you get of folks here in Michigan in terms of their view of the president's economic policy, whether or not something like this even matters? I mean, he did get the tax cut passed.
He did.
And I think for supporters of the president, that tax cut was a big, big win. Maybe something like this in the scheme of things, not the biggest of big deals compared to the fact that he got that big piece of legislation done. For folks here in and around Detroit, what's your sense?
So, I mean, I think the biggest thing on people's minds here with regard to the economic policies of this administration is trade, right? The impact of this trade war he wants to start around the globe on automakers and auto suppliers. I mean, that is the lifeblood of our local economy still, and I think a lot of people are really focused on that. I think if you talk to Republicans in this state, though, about how Michiganders are responding overall to Trump, it's really remarkably solid, and you see it in the political races that are taking place in this state right now. Republicans are running to the president. They are not running from him. And I think 2 years in, that's a little bit of a surprise. I think Democrats in this state figured once this administration started doing things like starting trade wars, Republicans in Michigan would peel away. They haven't.
And it's very obvious, just even being here for the convention and looking at some of the TV ads that have been running.
They're unbelievable,
right? It's fascinating. It's interesting how every state's a little different, but the ads here in Michigan kind of, they're in a class kind of unique among...
They are bear-hugging Trump, Republicans in the ads.
There's maybe a few other politicians, a few in Florida that I've seen that are kind of that aggressively aligning themselves with the president. Regarding economic issues, Nancy wrote on our Facebook page, "So glad you are in Michigan. So many here don't realize that Michigan unemployment is still the highest in the region. Our median household income is below the U.S. median when Michigan used to be 13% above the U.S. median. And K-12 test scores have gone from the top 10 to the bottom 10 in the nation." We'll talk more about news from Michigan in just a moment, but another big national story follows up on our discussion on guns that can be created through 3D printers. The battle over them has been waging for years. The main activist in support of posting instructions for printing a firearm online is a guy named Cody Wilson.
I believe in it both because I'm like a romantic. For the political itself, I believe that anyone should be able to have this type of capacity. I know that this creates like a, this is a big problem. And if the question is, what's the moral good of it? Well, I don't answer it that way. I don't see it as explicitly good or bad from a moral point of view. It's beyond good and evil, surely.
Cody Wilson won a settlement against the federal government. He was all set to publish these plans for guns online this Wednesday, but an emergency order from a federal judge blocked him from doing so at the 11th hour on Tuesday night. But you know how hard it is to stop something from spreading on the internet. Not surprisingly, they appeared online regardless. According to Fox News, on Wednesday, Amazon Web Services removed a website that had the plans available for download. That site was back up on another internet server the very next day. Eugene Scott, I'm not sure exactly where this story goes, but it's certainly a frontier of both First and Second Amendment law. I wonder if this kind of exposes where the government stands to wrap its arms around some of these bleeding edge tech issues.
Absolutely. I was reading how some of the concerns about the gun specifically revolve around whether or not they would make it through metal detectors, because it is possible that some of them can operate without metal. Plastic is the most commonly used material for making these. And I think the larger question many people are asking, regardless of whether or not the pioneer behind them wants to address it, is whether or not this is a moral issue or not. Who gets to have these guns? What type of process will individuals go through before getting access to these printers and this information that allows them to make these very dangerous weapons in their own home to be used for reasons possibly less noble than what is being communicated by many Second Amendment rights activists?
Yeah. Although it is worth noting, I think the guns that are made of plastic can only fire once, but you know, once may be all it takes.
Right.
We are broadcasting, as we said, out of WDET here in Detroit. There's plenty of news here and in the rest of Michigan this week, so we wanted to camp out a bit on Michigan news, particularly the story of Dr. Larry Nassar. He's appealing to get his prison sentence shortened. Currently, he could essentially die behind bars for criminal sexual assault. He's the guy who worked with Michigan State Athletics and USA Gymnastics and has over 250 accusers, many of whom collectively received the Arthur Ashe Award for Courage at this year's ESPY Awards. Stephen Henderson, what's the latest with this appeal? Has he said why he believes his appeal has merit?
Well, I mean, I think he feels like the judge piled on. I mean, he was sentenced to consecutive terms in prison, and he thinks that he should be able to serve them concurrently. That's not an uncommon appeal in legal circles. Lots of people make that appeal on their own behalf after they're in jail. I think here it's the circumstances that are extraordinary, of course. I mean, Dr. Nassar is responsible for abusing more than 200 young women at Michigan State University. And if you were here at all during the trial in which many of these young women came and talked about what happened to them, as the judge allowed them to do, you saw the tremendous impact that he had on these women and the entire university and the entire state. So I think it's a real long shot that any judge would really want to step into that and say, oh, yeah, you can serve less time in prison than you've been sentenced to.
We mentioned some of the political ads running here in Michigan. The primary is on Tuesday. A number of big races there, Senate race and also House seats. Estead, you did some reporting you mentioned about the race to find a successor to longtime Democratic Congressman John Conyers. Mm-hmm. I mean, shoes that can never really fully be filled. I mean, he was a kind of a giant of the House, but what's your sense of what people are thinking going into that race and what they're looking for?
Yeah, this is a race that's really convoluted. There is five or six major candidates. There's folks of kind of every side of the spectrum. You have a really well-liked, well-known city council president from Detroit, Brenda Jones, who's running. You have Ian Conyers, who is John Conyers' great nephew. You have Coleman Young II, who's the son of the legendary mayor here. You have Bill Wild, a white mayor of the Detroit suburb Westland, who may benefit because the vote will be so split. You have Rashida Tlaib, who's running kind of in the mold of Bernie Sanders and is maybe the first Muslim woman ever elected to Congress. You have such a wide scope of candidates, and there's kind of no real consensus around who's the forefront. What I will say is that this kind of a choice of the new identity of the place that I think is important to mention. You have John Conyers, who, while a legend, was there first elected in 1964. I mean, I had voters who said, who told me, you know, while we respect John Conyers, this community has drastically changed, and sometimes for the worse, under his watch. And they think of this kind of election as a chance to really make a stamp on what should be their representation going forward.
Another big Michigan story that continues to captivate us is the Flint water crisis. Communities are still recovering from the water crisis that was uncovered in 2014. Stephen, the governor, Governor Snyder, and the state were dismissed or were released as defendants in the case this week. Is this just a kind of a procedural move, or is this a significant change?
Well, I mean, I think in legal terms, it is a procedural move. I mean, I think there was real doubt about the ability to assign legal culpability individually to the governor and the people around him, because it's unclear who made what decision when and who knew what when. And that's been the sort of struggle to figure out since this happened. At the same time, as a cultural sort of event and moment, the culpability lays entirely with the governor, right? I mean, he was in charge of the state at the time this happened. This will be, I think, the primary facet of his legacy as governor. I mean, I think it's hard to come up with very much else that he will be known for other than the bankruptcy here in Detroit. And so no matter whether he can be prosecuted or not, again, is a legal question, but whether he is responsible for this, I think everybody in Michigan really believes that.
This week, the Me Too movement saw a spate of allegations against top men in media. CBS president and CEO Les Moonves was the subject of a piece in The New Yorker. It cited six women saying that Moonves had sexually harassed them, with some allegations dating back to the 80s. CBS is investigating the allegations, but has not taken any actions yet. Yesterday, it reported quarterly earnings, but its executive VP, Adam Townsend, said the company would not address anything but the quarterly finances. Stephen Colbert, the host of The Late Show on CBS, said this on his program a few nights ago.
Everybody believes in accountability until it's their guy. And make no mistake, Les Moonves is my guy. He hired me to sit in this chair. He stood behind this show while we were struggling to find our voice. He gave us the time and the resources to succeed, and he has stood by us when people were mad at me. And I like working for him. But accountability is meaningless, unless it's for everybody.
Part of Stephen Colbert's comments on The Late Show. I know we're low on time, but Eugene, this seems to be kind of it's a tough situation. I wonder where this leaves us in terms of the Me Too movement, particularly high-profile men who aren't just the stars in front of the camera, but the ones who are making decisions at the top of the boardroom.
I think this is hopefully going to be the new norm as companies are reexamining their own histories and how they have treated women in their workspaces. And hopefully we're seeing this expand. We're seeing situations like the incidents related to Representative Jim Jordan, where people are having to ask how were not only women treated, how were minors treated, how were men treated, how have we just treated other human beings when it comes to respecting their own autonomy and how their bodies should be handled.
Eugene Scott, politics reporter for The Washington Post. Eugene, thanks for spending the hour with us.
Thanks for having me.
Stephen Henderson, editorial page director. Excuse me, Stephen Henderson, the host of Detroit Today here on WDET Public Radio. Thank you, Stephen.
Great to see you again.
And Ested Herndon, national politics reporter for The New York Times. Thanks, Ested.
Thanks so much.
One more thing. Brian tweeted, welcome to Detroit 1A. Make sure you enjoy a Coney dog before you leave. A vegan option now available.
Only have one.
Exactly. I hear there's some very angry Detroiters. Before we go today, we wish a happy birthday to the incomparable Tony Bennett. The jazz singer turns 92 today. You'll hear him as we leave. We'll dive into the international section of the Friday News Roundup in just a moment.
Doorbells and sleigh bells and schnitzels with noodles. Wild geese that fly with the moon on their wings. These are a few of my favorite things.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from ACT, a flexible CRM trusted by millions worldwide. Manage customer contacts, track sales opportunities, and create professional marketing campaigns, all from your laptop or mobile device. Call 888-643-6400. Mention promo code NPR for a free Amazon Dot with your purchase of ACT. Or visit act.com/NPR to sign up for a free 14-day trial. ACT. Growth made easy.
Hey, it's Guy Raz here, and on the latest episode of How I Built This, how Stuart Butterfield failed in two companies, pivoted, and then built two amazing new companies, Flickr and Slack. Check out How I Built This wherever you listen to podcasts.
The president will be taking some time away from the White House in the weeks to come. He insists it's not a vacation. He says he hates them. But for the rest of the world, August is when you might expect things to get a little quiet. Millions of us are taking a break from the office. Having said that, the news from overseas is as busy as ever. And there is a lot to tackle today in the Friday News Roundup. We're delighted to be joined here in Detroit by three journalists who, like us, are in town for the annual convention of the National Association of Black Journalists. Ron Nixon is Homeland Security correspondent for The New York Times and the author of Selling Apartheid, South Africa's Global Propaganda War. Ron, welcome back to 1A.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Karen Atiyah is The Washington Post's Global Opinions Editor. Karen, welcome.
Hi, thanks for having me.
And Hayes Brown is Deputy World News Editor for BuzzFeed News. Hayes, glad to have you with us.
Glad to be here.
Let's begin in Africa. Zimbabwe has a new president. Emmerson Mnangagwa seized power from President Robert Mugabe in a coup last year. This morning, he was declared the winner of the election, but that result is being disputed. After what had been a pretty peaceful election, earlier as the votes were being counted, things got violent. Six people were killed in the capital, Harare, after running battles between the security forces and supporters of the opposition leader, Nelson Chamisa. Mr. Chamisa says the polls were rigged. Here he is speaking to reporters before this morning's announcement, insisting he had won the election.
We know the results, my brother, and this is where I want to correct you. The results are known by all Zimbabweans.
So what next? What do you tell your supporters to do?
I've said our supporters must be calm and anticipate massive celebration in peace. We won this election.
That was Nelson Chamisa, the opposition leader, speaking before this morning's announcement. Zimbabwe's Electoral Commission declared Emmerson Mnangagwa the winner this morning. This was the moment they made it official.
The votes received by Mnangagwa Emmerson Dambudzo of ZANU-PF party are more than half the number of votes cast in the presidential election. Therefore, Mnangagwa Emmerson Dambudzo of ZANU-PF party is therefore duly declared elected president of the Republic of Zimbabwe with effect from the 3rd of August, 2018.
Ron Nixon, let me start with you. This is a gigantic moment for Zimbabwe. My entire life, that country has never known a president whose name was not Robert Mugabe.
Exactly.
What's going on in this moment right now, though? What's happening?
So, as you mentioned, this is historic that Zimbabwe finally has another president not named Mugabe since the country was declared independence in 1981. He has been president. So, with Mr. Mnangagwa becoming, helping to engineer, they didn't exactly call it a coup last year. it was coup-ish, but and becoming, you know, president until they could hold an election, having him become the president is certainly a new for Zimbabwe in that he was elected, even though there were some irregularities, I believe about 250,000 irregular votes. And what's even though it was democratically elected, there are some concerns because the military was a little bit more involved than people would like. As you mentioned, that there were six people who died in clashes with the military. And I think there's still some cloud over this election simply because of the military's involvement, the irregular votes, and the fact that the ballots were done in a way that had that created prominence for the ZANU-PF over the MDC, the Movement for Democratic Change.
So Mnangagwa is like, a ZANU-PF candidate.
Right, right. So it appears in some ways that it was set up to help them maintain power. Although I will say the election was closer than most people thought. You know, Mnangagwa won by 50.8%, right? Mm-hmm. Which is like, you know, Mugabe was winning by 95% or so. So
yeah, and Karen Atiyah, I wanted to ask you about Robert Mugabe. I mean, Mnangagwa and Mugabe are both from the same party, ZANU-PF. Mr. Chamisa is from the MDC, the Movement for Democratic Change. How much of a shadow did Robert Mugabe cast on this election? He had been commenting on the election like right up to Election Day and I think endorsed Mr. Chamisa. He endorsed the opponent.
Right, absolutely. I mean, it just sort of follows – my family's from Ghana originally, and it just sort of follows and how former presidents still try to maintain – I'm thinking of Jerry John Rawlings in Ghana – and still try to maintain, even criticize the former parties that they were a part of and maintain a shadow over politics and elections. And it speaks to some of the concerns maybe the people had about Ernest Mnangagwa from the beginning. How much of this is a change if he was Mugabe's almost right-hand man in some levels? Not only that, I think it also speaks to if we're talking about, you know, the shadow of Mugabe, who is how old is he?
94.
Mnangagwa is 70. Yeah. Is 70 years old, right? And so there are questions, you know, even and this is a question across Africa of aging leaders. I'm thinking also of Muhammadu Buhari of Nigeria. Aging leaders that are representing countries that are increasingly younger, increasingly more connected. But again, the shadow and the legacy of Mugabe, it also speaks to what is the role of these former liberation or these liberation parties that are still hold resonance but are entering into a time where people are moving further and further away from the liberation struggles, especially the youth, right? The liberation struggles that that put these leaders into power.
And yeah, I do want to confirm Robert Mugabe is 94 years
94.
Old.
94, okay.
Cool, February 21st, 1924. You know, so he is
still holding on,
exactly. Hayes Brown, what about the actual concerns over the election and where this goes next? I mean, the Zimbabwe Electoral Commission said there was, to quote them, no skullduggery at the polls. Does anyone believe their claim? I know that the security of the elections was something that came up in the months before this vote, particularly the prospect that an elections commission that existed for all that time with Robert Mugabe could suddenly be trusted to just do a free, fair election when Mugabe wanted anything but a free and fair election.
Right. So there were observers on the ground during this election. The European Union said that they were not entirely free and fair, was, I think, their very delicate phrasing. They wouldn't sign off completely. So I think that, though, the fact that this election was so close, only 300,000 votes or so separated Chamisa from Mnangagwa. So I think that if it is the case that the Electoral Commission was engaged in skullduggery, in fact, they've gotten very good at it. It's seeming like much more credible than the giant, massive dictatorship victories that you normally saw in Zimbabwe. And I think that the way that the results were announced, they did it by the different precincts or provinces in Zimbabwe, 10 in all. And if you look at the breakdown of them, it tracks well with where people thought the votes would be coming from for each candidate. Mostly the ZANU-PF was winning in the rural areas, and the MDC won huge in the urban areas. Part of the reason why the vote was so close was because of the massive lead that the MDC had in Harare, the capital. So I think that if the election was in any way tampered with, they've done it in such a way as to actually make it look from the outside is quite credible.
One listener emailed, "The reporting on Zimbabwe's election and politics is silent on the issue of tribalism. Mm. The irreconcilable antagonism between the Ndebele and Matebele, for example, can never be resolved at the ballot box. Would the panel address the role of tribalism in Zimbabwe's political life?" Ron Nixon, I wonder if you can take this one.
You know, I think this is less of a factor than it has been in the past. The thing that the ZANU-PF was good at under Mugabe was just pulling people in by bribes and coercion, and so I think tribalism is less of a factor than it has been in previous elections. I think it's still a factor. I don't think it's a major factor, though.
Regarding Robert Mugabe, James tweeted, "Perhaps Mugabe's quote-unquote endorsement was a kiss of death meant to have the opposite effect." Hmm. Karen, what do you think?
That is an interesting proposition.
Like kind of throwing a monkey wrench on his way out.
You know, I mean...
Which, I mean...
Especially given how he was shown the door.
Right. And I hear Hayes, I hear you saying that MDC, the opposition party, was kind of solid in Harare in the days leading up to the election.
Yeah. I mean, I think it all, just again, the razor-thin margin, it's a reminder to the ZANU-PF that their mandate is narrow. And... Mnangagwa said in his sort of tweets after the win that, you know, he promised transparency and an investigation into the killings. And so you just wonder, it's something to watch out for with such a narrow sort of mandate. How will, people are wondering, is force going to be, or the use of the military going to be a tool or in how, in gaining perhaps legitimacy, right? And then also we have to not ignore the role of the opposition. And I think when we think about election results, we often look to, you know, will the opposition accept the results? Will they continue or not continue in inflammatory rhetoric? There are a lot of calls for Zimbabwe to quote unquote move on, which I think is very can be seen as very problematic in very many ways. It's just looking to see how this country will be able to move forward in a very positive and democratic way.
Ron, there was one more thing you wanted to mention about the election in Zimbabwe, especially related to who the vice president is.
Yes, the vice president is a former general who was involved in the removal of former President Mugabe. Who then left the military supposedly for civilian life and turned up as the vice president, you know, as a candidate for the vice president, and is now the vice president. So it does raise the question about the role of the military in this new government.
And Karen, we'd have been hearing about Robert Mugabe's wife leading up to the election. Did she turn out to be a factor at all?
Yeah, I mean, after the coup light or coup-ish events that unfolded, there was a lot of discussion, particularly in African circles, about the role of Grace Mugabe, who was a firebrand, and people sort of blamed her almost militant rhetoric for his fall, that she was too much. There was almost a strain of sexism, even. Right. Blaming her for what happened with Mugabe and all of that. So it'd be really interesting to sort of follow in general what will happen with Mugabe, but in particular also women, I think, in politics. And there's a lot of sexism that people were complaining about when it came to the Zimbabwe campaign. So it'll be really interesting to see how that plays out.
We'll get back to stories out of Africa a little bit later on, but we wanted to move on now. Talk to a few stories out of North Korea. The government in Pyongyang turned over what are believed to be the remains of American troops killed during the Korean War more than 60 years ago. Right. 55 crates of remains arrived in Hawaii this week. Yesterday, we spoke to Kelly McKeag, director of the Defense POW/MIA Accounting Agency, which oversees the search and identification of Americans missing in action.
The North Koreans cooperated with the United States in the early 90s, and they returned 208 boxes, the largest of which was 33. So yesterday represented the largest single unilateral turnover that the North Koreans have provided the United States. Our scientists, in their initial forensic review, determined these remains to exhibit characteristics of those that they returned in the early 90s. So again, we believe that there is a higher than probable cause that these are American soldiers and Marines who gave their life in North Korea.
Kelly McKay, the director of the Defense POW/MIA Accounting Agency. Hayes, give us a sense of what happens now. The remains are back in the U.S. Mm-hmm. I imagine there's quite a task in terms of identifying them, getting them back to the families, and so on. What happens next?
So what's next is they actually go through the process of, you know, running their forensic verifications to make sure that these actually are American citizens, that they are from the time period that North Korea is claiming, which so far it seems to be the case. It seems to be like they do exhibit the signs of being Americans. What's interesting about this project is that it's been ongoing for so long, this whole repatriation thing. And as we heard in that clip, in the early 90s, there were efforts. In the early 2000s, there were also efforts to get these remains back from North Korea. And both times, it was the U.S. who actually pulled out. The first time because we were having trouble verifying who actually we were having returned to us. And in the latter case, just because of how negotiations were going. But the technology has gotten much better since then. They are able to determine with a very high degree of accuracy who is in these crates. And so once that's done, it'll be a matter of notifying the families. And I would assume that there will be options for burial at Arlington National Cemetery and things of that nature.
We did speak to one family on this program recently, one person who's already got a plot at Arlington for her loved one, and she is desperately hoping that his remains are among those that are returned. Ron Nixon, I wonder if the forensic part of this is almost the easy part. I mean, DNA technology has come so far in the last few years, it's not even funny. Right. I wonder if maybe the diplomatic piece is the challenge. Brian emailed, if these are really the remains they are purported to be, I'm happy for the families to finally have closure. What bothers me is Trump thanking and congratulating Kim, meaning Kim Jong-un, for their return, as well as the return of hostages a few months ago. Right. These remains and the hostages were taken and or held illegally, were they not? The North Koreans never should have taken them to begin with, and to now be lauded by the President of the United States for their return grates on my nerves.
Right. No, I think that there's merit to that. And I will say personally, as a veteran, as a former Marine, a lot of these missing servicemen were veterans of the Battle of the Chosin Reservoir, which is a huge thing for the in Marine Corps history that we are taught in boot camp about this. And I think that, you know, sort of congratulating North Korea for something that, you know, just should have been done. That's a diplomatic norm to turn over the remains of servicemen from the various wars. You know, we've done it with Vietnam. We've done it in other wars. And to say, you know, to give the leader of North Korea, you know, the credit for something that you should have done anyway. But also, I do think that you have to look at the, as Haynes mentioned, the history of this and how the U.S. has pulled out the couple of times that we have tried to get these remains back. But it's complicated because it's something that I'm sure the president is trying to like get an international win in his word, but it's probably not the place to do that.
And I just want to make sure we don't miss part of the point you're making, Ron. Right. These are not just service members who happen to be in North Korea. Right. What you're describing is that the battles with which their service is ascribed are significant in American military history.
Yes, yes.
Hayes?
I just wanted to add to that I think that we should, you know, be glad that this step was taken, that it is a baby step. What we shouldn't do is let the president off the hook for calling it early. Let's not forget that he said that the remains were back in the U.S. far before the deal was actually made, far before anyone's remains were loaded onto a plane. He said that they had already been repatriated to the U.S. Right. So this currently being true does not overwrite the fact that it was false then.
I wonder, Karen, if we could move on with North Korea, particularly the larger North Korea story that many Americans had been following, which is this effort toward denuclearization. Mm-hmm. This week, the Washington Post reported that North Korea is building new long-range missiles and exploring ways to hide the extent of its nuclear weapon program from the U.S. This was always a concern. This is a concern that's come up in the past. Do we know anything more now about what North Korea may be doing to kind of to hide some of its activities, even as it's going through this diplomatic conversation about denuclearization?
Right. I mean, I think we do know, and several officials have said, you know, that the activity isn't surprising. And for all of Trump's rhetoric about securing a win, meeting with the leader, Kim Jong-un, this is exactly perhaps what everybody was afraid of, right? This sort of premature celebration of some sort of breakthrough. And then we see, wait, they're still doing what we told them perhaps not to do. And at the end of the day, they never agreed to give up their nuclear programs, right? We never got that concession. And so it was sort of, again, just reconfirming all the criticisms of even meeting in the first place or walking away without any sort of concrete promises, right? So I think again, it just shows sort of the regime that we're dealing with, right?
That's what I was going to ask you about, Karen. I mean, it's certainly troublesome if they're continuing to develop long-range missiles, especially now that we know they have the ballistic technology to basically hit anywhere in the United States. Mm-hmm. With a nuke, that's another matter, but they can reach a ballistic missile to the U.S. But they never said they wouldn't. So is this just kind of a procedural step? Like, is this as big a deal as it seems, or is this just kind of North Korea being North Korea?
I mean, I would look at it as North Korea is going North Korea.
I mean.
Yeah, North Korea going to be North Korea.
And so, I mean, a large part of this is also, about what options perhaps China, other players in the region could have to pressure North Korea to change its ways. And Trump and successive U.S. presidents have made that point, at least, that it's China, really, that could try to play a role. So again, I mean, for me at least, and I don't know how the other panelists feel, I feel like this is an example of, you know, North Korea pretty much acting in the blueprint that it set out, you know, for the last, as long as we've been under Kim Jong-un. Right.
I'm glad that you brought up the other players in the region, because Ron, I wanted to ask you about something related to Russia. The Wall Street Journal had a piece today about Moscow allowing thousands of new North Korean laborers into Russia, issuing them work permits. There's a UN Security Council ban on issuing work permits to North Koreans. Why might Russia be doing this now, and is there anything that can be done to prevent it?
On the second part, I can anything be done to prevent it? I would doubt it. I think Russia is doing it because Russia is doing what it's doing in its own self-interest. And I also think that Russia is doing this as a way of still showing the U.S. that, yes, even though, you know, our leaders have talked and, you know, exchanged pleasantries, we still have our own interest, and this is what we're going to do, despite what the U.N. or the U.S. or any of the European Western European powers say. So, you know, in talking about North Korea being North Korea, this is just Russia being Russia.
Mm-hmm. It's Russia, but Russia doesn't have a whole lot. I think China has more direct economic.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. China is by far the biggest trading partner with North Korea. And so Russia doesn't have as big as a role. But I think it's a way of trying to insert themselves into this. I would imagine they would have more of a relationship with North Korea than the U.S. does.
Mm-hmm. Hayes Brown, let's stick with Russia for another story. It came from The Guardian, a bit of a bombshell story. The Guardian reports that investigators have found and fired a suspected Russian spy working at the U.S. embassy in Moscow. The agent had reportedly been working for the U.S. Secret Service for more than a decade. Reportedly also, she had access to the agency's intranet and the email systems. The Guardian says this unnamed woman came under suspicion during 2016. She was quietly let go last summer. A statement from the Secret Service downplayed her role in the office, stating that her duties were, quote, limited to translation, interpretation, cultural guidance, liaison, and administrative support, unquote. How should we be viewing this? I mean, the potential of a spy to be in an embassy is a big deal. Just because those were the only systems she had access to doesn't mean those are the only systems she touched. But do we know anything more about how big a concern this should be?
So I think one of the most fascinating things about this is how she was let go. Right. The Secret Service let her go in the midst of an announced purge of Russian nationals working for the U.S. Embassy in Moscow as part for a tit-for-tat thing between Washington and Moscow a few months, like was it last year? Time doesn't make sense anymore, guys.
Yeah, it all moves pretty fast. Exactly.
But so they let her go during this wide purge in a way to sort of minimize like how big a deal it was. And it was only The Guardian and The New York Times' reporting that showed that this actually was a suspected Russian spy.
Right.
But spies have been in embassies for as long as we've had embassies. So on the one hand, we shouldn't be shocked or anything by this, the fact that Russia has managed to convince one of their nationals to pass on secrets to the Russian government inside an embassy. Not a shocker. What is surprising is how the U.S. has decided to play this. Instead of blasting out loud and clear, Moscow has had this person in our embassy. They've done it. They've had access to – just the lack of transparency is what's really concerning right. to me, actually.
Ron?
No, I just think this is sort of also speaks to this sort of two-headedness of the Trump administration's reaction to Russia. On the one hand, you have the president – acting in a certain way towards Russia, but on the other hand, you have the administration itself, you know, acting in a certain way that's actually, you know, I wouldn't say tough, but actually, you know, significant in their dealings with Russia. But
let me sidebar you there for just 1 second. Sure. I think all part of that, just to add to what you're saying, mm-hmm. is the statement that was made by the intelligence chiefs, the head of the CIA, right. the FBI, mm-hmm. the NSA, right. Homeland Security, saying right. that Russia is continuing its actions to interfere with our elections. Right. They mm-hmm. are coming after the midterms.
Right. Mm-hmm.
We are going to do everything we can to stop them.
Right.
And then hours later at a rally in Wilkes-Barre, Pennsylvania, the president referred to that Russian hoax.
Right, exactly. And that's the whole point about this is that – you know, the administration has well there's two ongoing competing different postures towards Russia from the president himself and then from his administration.
I wonder at what point does this actually begin to affect American foreign policy in a significant way? I mean, we have these two different right. movements, but as long as the intelligence community can do its job,
right.
I mean...
Well, but that's the question, because they've said they haven't been getting any direction on how to deal with this cyber attack. So I think it's already affecting U.S. foreign policy. And about a year ago, I was in Mexico, and I was talking to some officials there, and they were like, well, we don't know what the policy of the administration is, because we will hear one thing from the president, and then you talk to some other officials later, and it's something else. So I think that there's global confusion about what the U.S. foreign policy actually is.
Mm-hmm. Let's shift gears and talk about Iran.
Yes.
This week, President Trump offered to meet with Iranian leaders. Here's the president speaking at a White House news conference on Monday.
I would certainly meet with Iran if they wanted to meet. I don't know that they're ready yet. They're having a hard time right now. But I ended the Iran deal. It was a ridiculous deal. I do believe that they will probably end up wanting to meet, and I'm ready to meet anytime they want to. And I don't do that from strength or from weakness. I think it's an appropriate thing to do. If we could work something out that's meaningful, not the waste of paper that the other deal was, I would certainly be willing to meet.
Do you have preconditions for that meeting?
No preconditions. No. They want to meet, I'll meet. Anytime they want.
Part of the president's comments at a White House news conference on Monday. Now, this invitation followed a tweet that the president posted on July 22nd, warning Iran to, quote, and I'll read it the way it was written.
Okay.
In all caps.
Okay.
Right.
Never, ever threaten the United States again, or you will suffer consequences the likes of which few throughout history have ever suffered before.
Right.
Unquote. Can you tell it was written in all caps?
Oh,
okay. Karen, is this becoming the president's MO when dealing with difficult nations like North Korea? I mean, he ratchets up the rhetoric, makes threats, tries to make a deal. He's done kind of a mini version of this with Vladimir Putin a little bit. He definitely did this with Kim Jong-un. We've had some conversations on this program as to whether or not that strategy will work with Tehran, but this kind of just seems to be the playbook now.
Right. To be fair, I mean, Rouhani did have some strong words for the U.S. talking
right.
about, you know, a war with the peace with the U.S. If I might be misquoting, but peace with the U.S. would be unlike any other peace.
And war
with the U.S.
Right.
would be unlike.
You're talking about Iran's president, right. Hassan Rouhani.
Yes, exactly. But again, speaking to Ron's point earlier, because Trump has said that he was willing to meet with Rouhani, President Rouhani, under no preconditions. And then later, Secretary Mike Pompeo said, actually, wait, we have three conditions, a commitment to fundamentally in how they treat their own people, reducing their malign behavior, and then modifying their nuclear agreement. So again, it just speaks to the confusion that people might have with, are we dealing with Trump's words? Are we dealing with the Secretary of State, Mike Pompeo?
Oh, hold right there, Karen, sure. For just one second. I want to continue talking about Iran as we keep going with the Friday News Roundup with Karen Atiyah, Ron Nixon, Hayes Brown, and more of your questions in just a moment. Stay close.
Support for NPR and the following message come from U.S. Army Medicine, one of the nation's innovative medical institutions that puts healthcare professionals at the forefront of medicine. U.S. Army Medicine is an elite team pioneering new medical discoveries to make a difference in the lives of Americans. Army Medicine is your chance to push medicine further. Learn more at goarmy.com/amed.
I'm Ann Powers from NPR Music. Last summer, we launched Turning the Tables, a project that radically changed how we talk about the history of popular music, with a list of the 150 greatest albums by women. This week, we're launching Season 2, looking at the 200 greatest songs by 21st century women. Check out who made the list and who didn't at n.pr/turningthetables.
So, Hayes, we've heard the rhetoric coming from the president being with that tweet. It was a little gangsta toward Hassan Rouhani. Has Tehran responded since then? That tweet was the last that I've heard so far. Well, there was Rouhani's comments over the weekend, and then the tweet in response to those comments, the big all caps tweet. I think that's the latest. Has he responded?
I haven't seen any response from Rouhani or anyone else really in the Iranian government. But I think what's fascinating is the fact that it's been previously reported that Trump has really wanted to meet with Iran for a minute. Right. During last year's UN General Assembly, apparently, the U.S. asked several times to set up a meeting between Trump and Rouhani, and Iran was the one that said no. I think it's really fascinating the fact that we were talking a little bit earlier about the new playbook that Trump seems to have with these countries. And what's fascinating to me is how quickly these countries have picked up on it and are playing it better than the U.S., if I'm being honest. They see what Trump is trying to do, and they have been very strategic in denying it. You see it the same thing in the premature announcement that Vladimir Putin would be invited to the White House, with which Russia cannily said, no, we're good, actually. We're good. You can come to Moscow, but we're good on coming to the U.S., which is rather embarrassing. And I got to say, too, on the whole no preconditions thing, the fact remains that in 2008, then-candidate Barack Obama was on stage and said he'd meet with the leaders of Cuba, Iran, with no preconditions, and he was pilloried for it. So to see the lack of concern among some of the same people who were who thought that Obama was naive, who was naifish for even considering this, is fascinating.
Ron, before we move on from Iran, I would like you to talk a little bit about the Strait of Hormuz.
Right.
There have been some shows of force there recently by Iran, and this is one of these. It's one of these waterways around the world that we don't hear about much, but it's really, really important.
You can't emphasize enough how important this strait is. One third of the global tanker traffic comes through here. About 18.5 million barrels of oil, gallons of oil on these tankers a day come through here. So if there, you know, is any type of stoppage or delays in there, I mean, you're talking about significant hits to the world's economy. And so I don't think it has gotten enough of coverage of just how significant this area of the world is.
And just to be clear, the Strait of Hormuz is what it connects.
It goes
into the Persian Gulf,
right?
Yeah, into the
Arabian Sea. And all the oil-producing countries that are in that area.
And a lot of it kind of borders along Iran.
Right. So Iran and UAE, all those countries that are in there, it leads straight into the Persian Gulf.
So is the concern that the Iranians might try to limit traffic
to just block the flow overall? It sounds like just posturing at the moment, but it is a significant threat, though.
Hayes?
I just want to point out, though, that these exercises are annual. Iran does these every year. Right. And one of the things that's interesting about military exercises is the level of concern we all have when countries go through them, even though they're pre-announced.
Right.
Like, if the point of them is to make people sit up and pay attention and worry, should we really be covering them in a way that emphasizes that level of panic, is my question.
Well, I would agree with that, but I do think that, you know, given all the concerns about that region, that it is something that should be paid attention to.
Fair. Let's back up to Africa. There are a few more stories out of Africa that we wanted to talk about. And Karen Atiyah, I wonder if I might start with you with regard to the U.S. military. It says it's preparing to withdraw hundreds of its troops from Africa. Washington is shifting resources toward dealing with threats in China and in Russia. This week, U.S. defense officials said the troop cuts would involve scaling back missions in Central and Western Africa, where the focus has been on training local troops to tackle Islamist militant groups. Ron Nixon, you and I have spoken about that on this program in the past, and I definitely want to hear from you on this too. Speaking to the New York Times, the man in charge of the U.S. Africa Command, General Thomas Waldhauser, said, quote, "We are not walking away." Karen, how significant is this decision to reduce, but not eliminate, but reduce America's footprint in this part of Africa?
Yeah, I think for a long time, actually, there have been some concerns about our U.S.-Africa policy, that our U.S.-Africa policy was over-militarized, actually, and was focused so much on sort of threat containment. We, particularly, I think the U.S. was woken up to this when we had the deaths in Niger. And there were a lot of people who were asking, wait, what? We're in Africa? Wait, what? We have special ops? Wait, what? What are they doing? And I think for a long time, there have been concerns not only with the growing number of special ops forces, but also that it has not completely been in lockstep with our diplomatic efforts. We even remember last year when then Secretary of State Rex Tillerson, it was reported that he declined or didn't meet with the African Union chief. We still have issues with confirming an assistant secretary of state to Africa. And so I think there's in some ways, it's some people would say it's a positive development. I think to a certain extent, though, if we're talking about West Africa, we still have Al-Qaeda in the Maghreb. We still have Boko Haram, which is a massive threat, not only to Nigeria, but also Cameroon, Niger, the Chad Lake, Chad Basin area. And our approach of having not necessarily fighting ourselves, of course, but training local militaries. There has been success in Cameroon with that. There has been some success, particularly people think of our partnerships with Chad. But again, these questions of how effective have they been, whether or not those trainings will still continue, I think are important questions. But I mean, to be honest, I think we should really be, questioning what exactly we're doing and how do we measure success when it comes to that.
Now, General Carter Ham used to lead U.S. Africa Command. He seemed to back the move, but he was quoted in the New York Times saying, quote, "My concern in Africa is that with an already very modest presence and level of engagement, reducing that will lessen the likelihood for good outcomes across the continent," unquote. Now, General Waldhauser, the guy who's in charge of Africa Command now, said the cuts won't be that deep for Army Special Forces like Green Berets. Ron, I wonder what that will mean in terms of the good, what General Ham was describing, good outcomes, understanding that, as it's been described, America's job in Africa, especially in post-9/11 America, was never to be about boots on the ground.
Right.
It was about training the African armies.
To deal with the various insurgencies.
Right, let them be the boots, and we teach them how to do what we do.
Right, right. And so, listen, I think this speaks to a larger question about what is our Africa policy. And it doesn't appear that we have one. I mean, you know, in terms of development, diplomatic, and this military response, I think this pullback sort of seems to a lot of people that we're sort of abandoning what we've started there. And even with the concerns about the militarization of our presence there, it looks to be that the U.S. is simply just doesn't have a policy in Africa, doesn't really consider it to be very strategic in whatever that policy is, and that this is just a verification of that. And it comes at a time, too, where some of these insurgencies are popping up in weird places. Like I did some reporting with a colleague, Eric Schmidt, about the insurgency in northern Mozambique, which is as a group calling itself the Al-Shabaab. It's just not affiliated with the Somali group, just the name, the youth, has carried out attacks there, and no one seems to know what they're after. But again, the U.S. is pulling back at a time when these sort of things are popping up. And so that's I think that's the concern.
Karen?
Yeah, I totally agree that it does speak to this sort of vague and nebulous or non-existent U.S.-Africa policy. I think, though, when we're talking about insurgents and when we're talking about these uprisings, so much of it needs to also come with considerations about development, economic empowerment. Right. I mean, Africa, for instance, largely is moving towards the African Free Continental Free Trade Agreement, which hopefully will increase trade and economic partnerships across the continent, which hopefully will create jobs, which hopefully will be a sort of a way to address the instability that drives people to join these sort of movements.
Right. Hayes?
I think that the argument that the government had for this, for re-strategizing towards the big powers, I think that makes sense. For a long time, we've just thought about the DOD as having almost unlimited resources, and you have to prioritize what is more important. But I will say, I think that the one of the biggest concerns I think that civilian leaders should have is the domestic blowback for this sort of thing. Should there be another terror attack based out of Africa, based from these groups where Americans die? I think that's, I think, the bigger concern than for some of these civilian leaders than the broader strategic ideas about what the military is doing.
One more story out of Africa we wanted to get to as we're starting to wind down our conversation. There's something good happening in part of the Horn of Africa. The Economist reports that Eritrea and Ethiopia are making peace. Right. In recent weeks, Ethiopia's new prime minister and Eritrea's dictator signed a peace deal and reopened phone and air links between their countries. It matters because both of them have engaged in what many people regard as a pointless war that killed tens of thousands of people and achieved basically nothing. The Eritrean regime has been likened to North Korea's, minus the nuclear weapons, of course, but the country is ruled by a despot whose critics often end up dead. Ron, give us a sense of why it's important for us to be paying attention to stories like what's happening in Eritrea and Ethiopia, other than just the basic notion of, well, it's good they made peace.
Right. Well, I think, one, you know, obviously the U.S., like a lot of places, has a large Ethiopian population and is something of concern to them. Ethiopia is a U.S. ally and an important ally in that region. And this also comes at a time where Ethiopia's new leadership is pushing domestic reforms. You know, there's a pullback on the surveillance state. There's constitutional reforms that Prime Minister Ahmed wants to put into place. You know, there are a lot of Ethiopians in the U.S. and in the U.K. that have been exiled are now talking about going home. And so, you know, these are all positive developments for a country that is a key ally for the United States in that region.
All right, a few more things we wanted to talk about before we wind down the roundup. Let's talk in London for just a moment, where soccer season hasn't kicked off just yet, but visitors to the capital might have been forgiven for thinking it has. They were jubilant outside London's Court of Appeal on Wednesday. Tommy Robinson was the jailed British far-right activist backed by Steve Bannon. He was ordered freed from bail. Mr. Robinson went to prison after being found in contempt of court, but has since become an international cause celeb in far-right circles. Tommy Robinson founded the English Defense League, an anti-Islam and anti-immigration movement in the UK. It argues that Muslims are disproportionately responsible for crime in Britain, especially crimes against women and girls. Karen, can you give us a sense of what this Tommy Robinson case says about the UK these days?
Or says about the West, I think, writ large these days, that these figures are rising in sort of popularity, celebrity status, Remember, and correct me again if I'm wrong, if it wasn't an English Defense League tweet that Donald Trump retweeted, falsely pointing a picture of this Islamophobic imagery, right? And so, to a certain extent, you wonder how just, you know, the scenes coming out of England with the jubilation around his release will empower, again, other figures and only just serve to help raise the profile of the English Defense League to everybody's detriment.
One last quick story. You may have heard that a U.S. judge blocked attempts by a gun activist in Texas to post blueprints for a gun online that can be produced by a 3D printer. Some Australians are taking advantage of that story. Damien Power is a comedian who's launched a new tourism campaign to get Americans down under.
This is Australia. Beautiful, majestic, with its gorgeous beaches, lush rainforests, stunning deserts and snowfields. I know what you're thinking. We've got all those in America. That's true.
But in our ones, you won't get shot.
Australia only recently became a not-getting-shot destination. For years, we had relaxed gun control and heaps of mass shootings, so it wasn't really worth visiting Australia because it was pretty much the same as the US. But after the 96 Port Arthur massacre, when 35 people died, Australia saw a tourism opportunity in people not dying. So they brought in tighter gun control and banned semi-automatic weapons instead of just thinking and praying a lot. And if you love Australia, it's a great place to raise your kids who can graduate from school without getting killed. So come to beautiful Australia and don't get shot!
Don't die in America. Live in Australia.
Harsh. Very, very harsh. Karen Atiyah, the Washington Post Global Opinions Editor. Karen, thanks for talking to us.
Thank you so much.
Ron Nixon, Homeland Security Correspondent for the New York Times. Thanks, Ron.
Thanks for having me.
And Hayes Brown, Deputy World News Editor for BuzzFeed News. Thanks, Hayes.
Thank you.
Thanks also to WDET in Detroit for hosting us today. Check out more of their excellent reporting and their program, Detroit Today, hosted by Stephen Henderson, online at WDET.org. This program comes to you from WAMU, part of American University in Washington, distributed by NPR. I'm Joshua Johnson. Thanks for listening. This is 1A.